Nightlight has partnered with Fan Roll Dice by Metallic Dice Games to offer an exclusive discount on one of their gorgeous dice sets that we've fallen in love with because of their satisfying weight and, let's just be honest, sparklies. Not to mention their impeccably constructed dice accessories. In one word, velvet. Visit fanrolldice.com, that's FANROLLDICE.com, and use our discount code Nightlight for 10% off any new additions to your dice hoard. A portion of your purchase will come back to us and help support our shows. So go to fanrolldice.com with the discount code Nightlight to get 10% off of any additions to your dice hoard.
The Fable and Folly Network supports creators of exceptional audio stories, including the one you're listening to right now. If you love our shows, we want to hear from you. Complete our listener survey at fableandfolly.com/survey. This will help us learn more about you, what you like, what you'd like to hear more of, and how we can maintain an inclusive, safe atmosphere. As a thank you for your participation, we have extras and behind-the-scenes content from your favorite shows. Fans make the network what it is. Thanks for listening, and we can't wait to hear from you. Find our listener survey at fableandfolly.com/survey today.
Hi, I am Tanya Ransom, the creator and executive producer of Nightlight, a horror podcast featuring creepy tales written by Black writers from all over the world. And today I am here with R.J. Joseph, the author of Bettina and the first episode from season 5, Conflict Resolution. And I'm super, super happy to have Rhonda here today because Rhonda is honestly one of my favorite writers. So this is such an honor to have you on the podcast. How are you today?
I'm good, Tanya. Thank you so much for your kind words. I'm excited to be talking to you today because you're absolutely one of my favorite podcasters. So,
I just want to say, like, Rhonda is just an amazing human. We go to a lot of the same conferences, so we get to see each other fairly often. And like, I just consider you just a great human being in addition to being a great writer. So let's kick it off with just talking about your idea. Like, how do you come up with the ideas for, say, Conflict Resolution and Bettina? Where's your well of creativity?
Oh, I'm really lucky that almost anything can trigger an idea. And so I say that, like, just walking around in regular life, the idea from conflict resolution actually came from my now husband and I. When we were dating, we would go to the drive-in movie theater because we just love movies, and we still have a drive-in theater within driving distance to us. And coming home one night, we saw just this weird thing. So Jose is a truck driver. He sees a lot of weird stuff, and he sees creatures at night all the time on the road. And so one thing that he noticed was that this creature, whatever it was, its eyes did not reflect the light. We kind of laughed it off because the thing just kind of loped on off, and it just didn't seem like anything that we knew. And so the idea that grew from there was that whatever it was, I mean, it could have been, you know, this kind of a kind of a creature that could have been there just for us. I mean, right? Like, you know, so much. but I mean, like, just something as innocent as seeing a weird creature on the road in the dark of night. And I think these Texas back roads are really, really super
they're
dark.
Spooky.
They're very spooky. And so that's where that idea came from. And I mean, I can do almost anything and an idea will strike and I'll kind of go, oh, well, what if? Well, what would happen? And what was that? And how do I feel about this? So there are ideas just come from anywhere. The idea for Bettina drew from the fact that I've always wanted to do an homage to Poe. And my favorite Poe short story is Berenice. I'm always terrified by the idea that we get the viewpoint of one character, but we never understand how Berenice must have felt. So I always wanted to do a female-centered homage to Poe, and Bettina is what drew what came from that.
Well, I have to say, Conflict Resolution is hands down one of my favorite short stories ever. It's just like, it's such, I mean, and, you know, it might be because I can picture those, you know, creepy Texas roads.
Right.
You know, like it really, you know, really hit home for me in a lot of ways because, you know, I have had that same sort of experience that your husband has had where, you know, you see weird things that you're like, that there's something that's not right about that. And sometimes you can, you know, pinpoint exactly, you know, like the eyes aren't reflecting. Sometimes it's just something is not right about that thing and I'm not stopping. You know? I'm just going to keep it moving. So I found that story. Like, I don't generally get scared by stories or movies or anything like that, but I get unsettled. And I found Conflict Resolution to be, you know, a story that actually unsettled me. And that's pretty rare. That actually happens to me. But Bettina, I also, like, I love it for different reasons. You know, like for me, Bettina wasn't so much about the being creeped out sort of factor. It was more, you know, that it was obvious that this was, you know, at least to me anyway, because I love Poe, that it was a story, you know, that was a play on Poe's work. And then when you mentioned that on Twitter, after the story went live, I was like, oh yes, like I nailed that. You know, I'm so glad that, you know, I went with the voice that I did for the narration and all that. But like, I'm a huge, huge Poe fan. So I'm curious, out of all of Poe's stories, which is your favorite?
So Berenice is my absolute favorite. I was terrified the first time I read it. As a young person, because the idea that someone could reduce a person to just like these certain body parts was terrifying, even before I understood the broader implications of that. You know, as a kid, you just kind of go, oh my gosh, he was so worried about her teeth. And like, after she died, he took her teeth out. Like, why would you do that to a person? She's already suffered so much. So I realized as an older person who's had more life experience now, that it's even doubly more terrifying because of that fixation. And I mean, we see here in current events where people are always being reduced to just their body parts, you know, throughout history, just the body parts. And so that whole thing, I mean, I was thinking that he was kind of before his time.
And, oh yeah, 100%.
Yeah, and showing how utterly terrifying something like that would be. I think we take a lot of that stuff for granted, but I mean, the reality is if all you're valued for is a particular body part, I mean, then what? What do you even do with that?
Right. Terrifying. Exactly. Well, I would hope that, you know, Poe is looking down or up, you know, wherever he is, and, you know, is happy about, you know, some of these adaptations to his stories. But I'm curious about your writing process. What does your writing process typically look like?
So I do a lot of my drafting inside my head. So I spend a lot of time inside my head thinking about like what the story is supposed to be, what it is that I want it to do. And I spend a ton of time allowing the story to tell me that. So I'll chew on a story for years, sometimes months, years, days. It's very rare that I write something in just one sitting. I've done it before. There are a couple of stories that I can distinctly remember doing that with, but that's out of the ordinary for me. Usually I have to chew on it for a bit, kind of figure out whose story is it to tell, which point of view the story needs to come from, because I don't really like false starts. Once I can sit down and actually crank out a draft, I really like for it to be a pretty clean and solid draft. So I do a lot of the drafting inside my head while I'm doing other stuff. So the process kind of looks like you have this weird idea. I chew on it for a bit. I decide who it is that's supposed to tell the story. I kind of usually have a title in mind already. I'm pretty lucky with that too. Like, I'm pretty good at titles. Matter of fact, I just wrote the very first story ever that I had where the editor suggested a different title. And I think that that's pretty cool to have that experience, but it's one that's really new for me. And it actually was appropriate for this particular story. The title that I have is not the best title. So usually I'm pretty lucky. So I have this title, I have this point of view character, I have this set of things that are going to happen. And that's when I finally sit down to draft the story. And like I said, usually those first drafts are pretty clean. And then I just kind of go through and tinker with it and figure out the things that I'm not really feeling about it. And then at that point, I kind of decide if I'm going to send it out. If it's something for an invitation, then I'll just send it on over to the editor. Now that's my short story writing. My writing process for other stuff is kind of different. For longer words, there's that same process, but more of it. And the drafts tend to take me a lot more time once I actually write them out. And on my screenplays, the process is even more different. Like, I am painstakingly slow with those. So, I mean, I'm always worrying about, okay, wait, this is not the best way to do this. So it's harder for me to turn off my internal editor for that process. Yeah, but like, so I mean, the process is different. My academic stuff, I'll tinker with that forever. So I'll write the essay and then tinker with the citations. I'll tinker with the sources and I'll kind of think about whether or not the thesis is actually what I'm trying to prove and, you know, always adding to that. So that even that is a whole different process.
Yeah, actually, that's a great segue into the next question that I had for you, which is, you know, tell me a little bit about your work as an academic, just to kind of give the listeners a little bit of background here. Rhonda is, I think this year also, you're still the Learn Track director at the Multiverse Convention, which is basically like a little mini academic convention for all things science fiction, fantasy, speculative fiction at the Multiverse Convention. You know, I've been there since the first Multiverse doing presentations for the Learn Track. So, you know, that's part of your work as an academic outside of your academic institution. But what kind of work do you do inside of your academic institution?
So here at my academic home, I'm an English professor. So I teach classes in the English and the honors department. So I teach things like composition 1 and 2. I teach British, American, and world literature. When I'm really super fortunate, I can kind of teach creative writing. I do teach an honors composition 2 class, and then also an honors writing seminar where the honors students are working on sort of a capstone project for the semester with a different honors professor and discipline. And I'm actually providing in-depth writing and research resources and support for them.
That's awesome. You know, I've spoken with, you know, several people who teach, you know, some level of English at different institutions. And it seems like most of what you do is the core, you know, classwork. And then, you know, the folks that get lucky or, you know, lucky for a semester get to teach creative writing. What would you say is like the biggest difference between teaching, you know, more those more fundamental sort of courses versus the creative writing courses? I mean, obviously, like, we love creative writing, you know, otherwise we wouldn't be doing this. But I'm curious, you know, what else makes those classes preferable to the core classes?
Oh, my gosh, the sheer workload. Composition classes are core classes. They also tend to be those, as much as I hate to say, they're like the gateway classes, especially Composition 1. So when we're teaching Composition 1, there are all these state requirements for, you know, for instance, teaching a certain number of essays in the semester, meeting certain learning outcomes. And every class has those requirements, but for composition, they can be a little more daunting because these are also typically students who are in their very first semester of college. So Composition 1 is the prerequisite course for a lot of other classes on campus. So we typically get the students who are straight out of high school, which can be really cool. But the sheer workload of teaching that many essays, teaching those kind of writing and research fundamentals, it is very much more time intensive for me. But I didn't realize that I'm actually very fortunate that even when I was an adjunct, I was hired to teach these classes, because it's my understanding that when you have an MFA and you go to try to teach, they sometimes some institutions feel that you can't teach anything but creative writing. So I kind of got lucky that they were like, oh yeah, cool. You have the qualifications and your presentation is good and all your bona fides stack up. So cool. Come teach these classes for us.
That's great. Okay. So outside of teaching, what else does your academic work entail, both inside and outside of your institution?
So inside my institution, I have actually worked on an academic conference here on campus. COVID kind of messed us up a little bit with the whole planning and whatnot, but we did have two iterations. So I was really excited to be able to head that up, to be able to take on, proposals and plan the schedule, kind of building panels. So I am very fortunate that my dean is supportive of that. So he's really supportive of that academic conference, and it will come back one day, hopefully next year. So I do get to do that. We also do, because I'm at a community college, there is work for the community that we do. So I sometimes teach classes over at what we call the Academy for Lifelong Learning, which is sort of a 50-year-old plus program where people who are interested in learning a variety of things can sign up for those classes. So I have taught over at ALL, is kind of what the acronym is. I've taught memoir writing classes, creative writing classes, and horror writing classes. And so that's a really good way to kind of, be in the community and to give back to that. And I'm also an academic writer. So usually, except not write this present moment, which is kind of weird now that I say it out loud, I'm usually working on an academic essay for a call or for a conference. And see, I say that, and I am working on one right now. So I do academic work mostly related to the horror genre or pop culture or even the romance genre sometimes. And I take a really close look at race and gender, the intersections of those in these spaces. So I'm really lucky to have all this kind of tie together.
Yeah, that's amazing. Out of curiosity, that horror writing class, for the community, what kind of demand is there for that?
Well, funny, the first time I went to teach it, I had about 5 students, and they did not realize that it was horror focused. Even though it was there in the description, I think they just kind of skipped it.
Just saw it was writing and signed up for it.
Yeah. So we got it.
Yeah, I've been there.
Yes, on the first day, there was this moment of, oh, wait, this is horror writing.
Yeah,
and I go, I was like, I'm flexible. It's not like a whole semester class anyway. It typically just runs for a certain number of weeks. So yeah. I just kind of told them on that first day that I was not averse to using it as a general creative writing class, because writing horror is still the same as writing other stories. The elements that go in the stories are just different. So we kind of did a sort of a hybrid where those that really wanted to do some horror writing, we kind of dipped our toe in. But for the most part, we just talked about story building instead in a general way.
I love that you adapted. I think a lot of instructors would have just been like, well, this is a horror writing class. We're just going to keep doing that. And if you want to write horror, there's the door kind of thing. But, I've experienced that same thing. I did volunteer at my local library for a while, and now they pay me to come and do stuff, which is great.
Nice. Yeah.
But, I've taught a couple of workshops, and people don't, unless it's in the title, people don't necessarily notice that. And you'll have people show up that are just like, oh, it's writing. And it's like, okay, well, that's good. You don't have to write horror, it's fine. But, my tips are going to be about, how to build tension and dread, which you can also apply to your writing regardless. Even romance has, tension, obviously.
Exactly.
Just a different kind of tension, but, really, adapting to that. And I think, honestly, approaching it in that way where, you don't try to force people to write horror, even though they signed up for a horror writing class. Really, I think, I don't want to say like the horror genre needs to rehabilitate its image, because I don't think that the horror genre has done anything that would lend to a lot of ideas that people have about horror writers and writing horror. But, you know, I think a lot of people are a little bit averse to writing horror because they, especially here in the South, because, you know, they've been told all their life that, you know, horror is bad, it's the devil's work, blah, 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 you know, and, you know, really showing people how receptive we as horror writers and horror teachers are to different aspects and genres of writing, I think helps to hopefully bring a few more people over to the dark side, so to speak, they kind of realize that, oh, wow, horror writers are not what I thought they were. You know, it's almost like a community outreach thing.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. At that point. Absolutely. I mean, in one particular iteration of that class, there was an attendee who was telling us about this situation she had at her house with sinkholes appearing. So she's like, I just had some sinkholes that just appeared in my yard. And
that's horrific.
I mean, and she's describing like what they found, because of course she talks about how she went to the sinkhole to see what was there. And all she saw was all these creatures who are, attracted to the moisture. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at her, and of course I'm going, okay, but do y'all hear what's happening here? This is a story unfolding right in front of us.
Right.
And I think that once I'm able to show people, hey, I know that horror sounds scary at first. It's kind of supposed to. It's right there in the title. But understanding that there are real life things that happen that can lend themselves to this being disturbed, to this being unsettled. I like to think that they leave out of there kind of realizing that, you know what, it doesn't have to be cliche or what I thought horror was about. I thought it was all about, you know, ghosts or gore and serial killers. And no, it doesn't have to be that.
Exactly. Yeah, I think a lot of people, you know, their concept of horror is definitely limited to like slasher type films, you know, gory things. And then, you know, there's the supernatural aspect. And then everything outside of that doesn't really like fall into horror in a lot of people's minds, which, you know, I find really interesting.
Right.
But I think, you know, at the end of the day, real life is always going to be scarier than anything anybody could put on page because it's real, you know? And so like the idea that this, you know, woman had a sinkhole in her back and went to go investigate. Was she
investigating? Yeah.
No. Like, was she white or black? Or, cause I feel like that's not a black people.
She was an older white lady.
I was gonna say that's not a black people thing. Black people to call somebody and be like, there's some shit happening in my backyard.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, and that's kind of the thing, because where my campus is kind of in this, you know, the homes here are like really pretty high value. And so, you know, the fact that she's talking about these sinkholes, and I know that the price point for the houses here start like at $400,000. Like, to me,
that is terrifying.
Yeah, but the fact that she was all just like, oh, yeah, it's no big deal. And, you know, and I just went to go see, and I'm just like, yeah, because you have money like that. I would have died.
Yes, exactly. Which leads me to, you know, like, another question. Like, I think our particular life experiences and where we are at a particular moment in time affect what is scary to us. You know, like that sinkhole experience wasn't that terrifying to her because, you know, she has the money. Like, that would have been terrifying, you know, for a number of reasons for me, not just, you know, financial reasons, but that wasn't scary for her. So it didn't register that could even be a horror story. So, you know, I'm curious, you know, you teach a lot of students, obviously. You know, and most of them, you know, I know are English comps. So they're, you know, not necessarily writing horror stories, but, you know, I'm assuming that, you know, some of their real life experiences bleed through in the work that they share with you. I'm curious as to, you know, maybe what trends you see and what people might fear right now. You know, what's scaring people?
Well, with the students, so I do try really hard to implement like literature throughout even my composition classes. We're always reading stuff that's happening in current events, and we're always doing analytical work. One thing that I noticed that students, especially particularly this semester and the last semester, One thing that really frightens them is anxiety and uncertainty.
Yes.
And I know that those are things that most, many of us humans, we are concerned about those things, but I find that my students are overwhelmingly so concerned about those things. Like, they're like, we don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
They're afraid of never being able to leave home. And this is even
Yes.
my old older students who are outside of that kind of traditional first time in college age. They're very concerned about, like, their independence, their financial status, like, how is this going to line up? How is this going to work out? Am I
Yeah.
going to be able to, get this degree, and is it really going to matter? So they are very afraid of uncertainty right now is a really big thing.
Yeah. Have you noticed any change in that, like pre versus post pandemic? Has it gotten worse? Is it about the same?
Oh yeah, no, it's gotten way worse.
Yeah, I kind of felt like that was
Yeah.
probably the case, but I didn't want to make any assumptions. I mean, certainly, like, even I, as not a young person anymore, am feeling anxious about my future. I feel like there's
Yes.
so much uncertainty with our government, with the world right
Yes.
now, with the
Yes.
way the government has handled certain things, is handling certain things. The way that we are being treated by the companies that we work for, these sudden layoffs and the fact that our economy is terrible and that even if we do have a job, it's not guaranteed to be there tomorrow. I just feel like there is a lot of uncertainty and anxiety in this
Exactly.
world right now. And I think that that is a perfect breeding ground for horror. Because if we look at the past, anytime there's been, a big societal change of any kind, horror has become a more lovingly received
Yes.
genre, I will say. And outside of those times of turmoil, people kind of look down on it. But during those times of turmoil, that's what people look to.
Yep.
So I'm really curious, like in your work, I know you've talked to, about how you do some work with race and gender and things like that. Do you do any work about how horror affects us as human beings, psychologically, helping us work through traumas, anything like that?
I, in a in an indirect way, I am often on my soapbox talking about trauma and who gets to own it, who gets to talk about it, who gets to tell you not to talk about it, because I find that there's this, I don't know if you remember, maybe a year or two ago, there started to be all this clamoring about trauma porn. Especially in regards to horror that centered people from marginalized groups. And I was immediately incensed by that whole idea because I thought, first of all, if it's my trauma and you can't tell me that I can't write about that. You can't tell me that I can't write these things. Like, first of all, it's mine. But second of all, I think that the horror genre is particularly open for this type of storytelling, for us to examine these things that are the traumatic things that are terrifying, that are violent, that are unsettling and disturbing. Because that is kind of what this genre does. And I, as a writer, am always examining those kinds of things. I'm always examining monstrosity, who gets to hurl the label around, who has to wear the label. Are they really monstrous, or are they just, victims of society? And so I do like to talk about the ways that horror is very useful in not necessarily maybe processing these things, but also in just shining a light on them. I mean, you don't come to horror to read about, unicorn, rainbow, glitter kitties. You don't. I mean, you just don't, unless that glitter is black and, it's like
And the kitties
short.
have very deadly teeth and they're venomous in some sort of way.
Exactly. So, I mean, so I. In my writing, in the writing itself, I am often challenging readers to think about that, to kind of think about, why is this horrific? What do you, how do you, does that make you feel? Can you not relate to this, right? And even if you can't, well, this is your introduction. You're welcome.
Okay, before we get to our final questions, I have one additional question for you. I would love to hear more about your work at Multiverse as the LearnTrack director.
Okay, yeah, I am really excited about that. And so one thing that we actually just announced a couple of weeks ago is that I am working with Dr. Bridget Kim, and I'm really sorry that I'm probably slaying this pronunciation of her name, her last name, on the Ayn Rand Con segment at StokerCon.
Yeah.
And so like working with StokerCon and Multiverse in doing these things is really important to me. I think that horror and speculative fiction as a whole, as academic disciplines and focuses, is really important. And so when I started working with Multiverse, it was really important to me to bring in, you know, these people from multiple disciplines who were examining speculative fiction through those disciplines. Because it's really intriguing work, but also the writing has been around forever. Like, speculative fiction is old. And
yeah.
So, you know, I think that it's really worthy of looking at through academic discipline lenses. And so we are, for Multiverse, we are right now in the process of, you know, collecting the abstracts, the proposals. And so what I and the assistant director do is we go through those and we look to see, first of all, do they fit our call for papers? Do they, you know, center and some type of an examination about speculative fiction? And then we start to kind of make the program from there. And of course, we always love to get, we love all of our proposals, but I think we get super excited when we have repeat presenters like you, hint hint.
Yeah, I was just saying, oh, like, dang, I didn't realize they were open. I need to send something.
Yes. The call for papers is open until June, I believe.
Yeah, that's usually when it closes. So.
Yeah,
I need to get on that. For some reason, I was thinking it didn't open until March.
I'm sorry.
For some reason, I was thinking it didn't open until March.
Oh, yeah. Well, because you're an academic and that's what we do, right? Anyway, okay. It's like, oh, I have 2 days to put this in. Okay, cool. Right.
Yeah. I actually had my shit together this last time. I had the proposal ready early.
Oh, nice.
And yeah. I, you know, researched it a little more in depth than I typically do before I send the proposal. So, like, my presentation was pretty much almost done.
Oh, wow.
When I did the proposal, like, I was so proud of myself. And I'm like, I need to do that again this year so I'm not, like, stressed out on the plane to Atlanta trying to put the finishing touches on my presentation. So, yeah, I'm definitely going to submit something again.
Yes, awesome. Thank you.
Can you share with our listeners what some of your favorite presentations at Multiverse have been for the LearnTrack specifically?
Oh, sure. Yes. Yeah. So, and this is not because I'm talking to you, but you came with your Anatomy of a Werewolf.
Oh yeah. It was the first one that I did. Yeah.
Yes. That was just phenomenal. We know that your presentations will always be very well attended because you are so detailed and thorough with your research, but also with the presentation itself, right? So it's very engaging. It's they're very interesting. There was John Edward Lawson did a presentation 1 year about I think zombies represent.
Yeah, we both did zombies unintentionally.
Yes. Well, I mean, and John is another one of those repeat presenters that we're just like all over. It's like, yes, he's coming back. This is great. We have had, there's another presentation that Kenneth Broom Jr. did. He's an academic that is kind of local there to Atlanta. And he did a presentation about this past Multiverse about grief and how it presents in certain horror films. And I thought that was really, really titillating. He's a really, really knowledgeable you know, academic. And so those are just some off the top of my head. I mean, all of them, I feel so lucky that I get to see them as they come in because I go, oh my gosh, I'm going to go to this one and I'm going to do that one. Yeah. You know, so we have never had a bad one. And again, when you're curating these, I mean, it's kind of hard to, if you're picking them, it's kind of hard to like pick a bad one, but, we really have not had any that were terrible. And so I'm really excited about that. Even the people that come new, like the new presenters, we get really excited about those too, because it's like, oh, there's fresh new blood here.
Yes. I'm gonna have to think of a creature for this year because I've done what? I've done werewolves, vampires, zombies, and sirens and mermaids. So yeah, I'll have to pick a different creature for this year. I'm actually working on a proposal for a book
Oh,
to
nice.
expand on all of those talks. I'm super, super excited about that. I'm super excited about Multiverse again this year. Multiverse is honestly my favorite conference to go to. Part of the reason is, there are a lot of friends there, but the presentations and panels are just so good. Like you can't go wrong. You can walk into any room at any point and you're gonna be hearing something interesting, which I really, really love. I love that, a lot of my favorite people are there. Like it's just great. A great conference all around. If I have to pick one conference to go to, it's gonna be Multiverse.
Well, thank you. The founders and Allie and Jesse, they work really, really hard. And the programming directors work really, really hard to pull this together. And I mean, I think that intentionality matters so much. And one of the reasons why I continue to work with Multiverse and I continue to attend is because they started out with the intention of creating an inclusive con. And that's exactly what they did. And I think that that's what sometimes people miss in the planning. It's like you can't hope that things happen. You have to intentionally plan for them to happen.
It's definitely Multiverse, I would say, is like probably the best model that I've seen for designing an inclusive space, an inclusive and safe space for everyone.
Oh, yes.
I
Agreed.
mean, like they were the first con that I went to that had like pronoun buttons or stickers or something like that. And then after COVID, they gave us bracelets for, like I'm okay with hugs, no hugs, or ask first. Like just, thinking ahead about all of those things. Like they're just, and I mean, like you said, Jesse and Allie are just great people. All of the track directors are great. There's you, there's Nicole Givens Kurtz. I think Nicole does she do fantasy or science fiction?
She does the sci-fi track. Marcus
Sci-fi,
Haynes, yeah, Marcus Haynes does fantasy.
and El Marie Wood is horror, right?
Yeah,
Or is
Grace
she still
Wood
horror this year?
yes, she is.
Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, it's just like, I mean, I love all the track directors. Like I've worked with you all in some capacity, at some point or another. And it's just, I mean, it's just a great conference. I highly suggest that everyone go to it. You're going to hear me typing for a second because I'm going to look up this address for you. So, you guys can get registered for this. Okay. It's multiversecon.org. So that you can check out. It's on October 20th through 22nd of this year in Atlanta. I highly, highly suggest that if you're able to, that you do attend. And if you're able to submit a proposal to Rhonda for the Learn Track, I highly suggest that you do that because Rhonda's just a wonderful person in general and, just consummate professional. Like I love working with you. Like you're so professional and so good at what you do. And like your energy is just so great. And it's, I don't know. I love you. I love you so much.
Yes, thank you. Same. I love you so much. Yes,
Oh,
you're doing really great work. And I'm
thank
proud of
you.
you too. Like
Oh,
sometimes
thank you.
I used to not be able to say that without worrying that people thought I was being condescending.
Yeah.
But then I thought, Rhonda, that's a you thing. Like you better tell folks when they're doing good work. You better tell them when you're proud of them. So this is me saying I'm really proud of all the work that you're doing, Tanya. This is
Oh.
great.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And thank you for the kind words, about my narration for Bettina. I mentioned this on Twitter. So, if folks follow me on Twitter, they've already seen this. But I was so nervous about you hearing that narration because, like, I felt like, man, I don't know. Like, I was in a weird headspace that week and I hated, like, everything I wrote, everything that I did. I just hated. And so, like, I was convinced that it was terrible. And I sent it to my sound designer, Jen Zink. And I was like, please tell me if this is bad and if I need to send this to someone else or re-record it or something. And she was like, no, like you did good. You did good. And I'm like, are you sure you just, saying that?
Yeah, no,
But yeah, it was just,
perfect. Like, it was perfect. I played it for, well, I played it for my daughter. I played it for Kiki. She's very highly entertained by your podcast anyway, though. So, like, she just likes the creepy story. So I don't, you know, I don't know how much she thought about the actual expertise that went into it. But, right. But, you know, I played it for Jose and he was like, oh, he was like, that's Tanya. I said, that is Tanya. I was like, how perfect is that? The accent, the pacing, the inflections. I was like, oh my gosh, she is just beyond talented. Because oh, you took you. This story that, I mean, of course I wrote it, of course I love it, but yeah. like you took it and made it into this whole other thing. It's almost like it's a separate thing now. You know, so there's like a story and then there's you actually performing the story. So it was so perfect. I mean, everything, I loved everything about it. A lot of times when people do narration on things that are supposed to have a Southern voice, they're not able to nail it. And so yeah. I was like, she nailed it. This is exactly what a Southern belle would sound like.
Oh, I'm glad. I mean, I did grow up in the South, so it wasn't, you know, super hard to,
yeah.
I shouldn't say what, you know, there is some thought that has to go behind like replicating voices and things like that. But I heard it enough growing up that it was, my job was a lot easier than, you know, if I'd grown up in the North. But I want to get to our very last question, or our second to last question, I should say, for you. If someone is new to Black horror in particular, what would you suggest they watch, listen to, read, you know, either name an author or a story, book, movie?
I would say that they should probably read Beloved by Toni Morrison.
Mm, yes.
Because not just because it's a classic, but because for a really long time, it wasn't considered horror. Dr. Kenitra Brooks kind of, she talks about this a bit in some of her works, but it was considered literary as opposed to horror. And so I think that that's one of the major books that starts to kind of delineate between Black experiences as horror. And like Tananarive Due, I would also suggest The Good House by Tananarive Due.
Oh yeah, that's such a good book.
And yeah, and as she's really, really known for saying is that Black history is Black horror.
Yes.
Yeah. And so I would very highly recommend Beloved. I would recommend The Good House. And I would also recommend the movie Tales from the Hood.
Oh my gosh. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. I think honestly, like that was one of the reasons that I got into horror short stories was watching Tales from the Hood. So did you watch the second one?
I did not watch the second one. And here's the thing. So, I'm really not a horror snob. When it came out, I meant to watch it. And then I just kept forgetting about it. And then I keep revisiting the first one. So it's like I'm stuck in this loop. But I mean, if it follows that tradition, I'm sure that it's great.
Yeah. I mean, the second one wasn't bad. I still like the first one a lot better. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think I wasted my time.
Yeah.
Watching the second one, but like the bar is so high.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like, yeah, because I was hesitant to watch it at first because I was like, man, that's like, you know, such a great memory from my childhood. And like, I'm scared to watch this and have that memory tainted.
Yes, yes.
Somehow. But, you know, that didn't happen. You know, a lot of people had some criticisms of it. And I think, you know, some of them were definitely valid. But I think overall, you know, it's worth watching. I don't know if it's still on Netflix or if, you know, it got pulled with like everything else that they're pulling from Netflix, but
I'm not sure, but I'm sure that I own the DVD somewhere, like just like that. So
yes. Okay, so to my final question for you, what can we as your audience do to support you and your work?
Oh my goodness, the thing that I think about most recently is to talk about it, to talk about the work, because that's really important. I think that sometimes as a Black female horror content creator, I sometimes feel like my work is invisible. So, I mean, people have nice things to say about it. I'm really grateful for the people that engage with it. And I'm always struck by the people that do this in good faith. They actually see these characters. And so what I find myself saying all the time is thank you for seeing us. Thank you for seeing these Black women. Thank you for doing that. So just engaging with the work and reading and talking about it is really important. Another thing that I've only recently started really thinking about is reviews. My brain doesn't always go straight to those, but I'm like, you know, reviews would be great. Ratings would be awesome.
Yes. Tell us about your collection of short stories that I still haven't read yet, but I really want to read.
Yeah.
When I have time.
Yes, I know. When we're doing all these other things, we just don't have time to read all the time. But my collection is a collection of horror short stories that really center Black female experiences. And so it's kind of a compilation of all of these things that frighten me, but not just that frighten me, but that I find frightening about society. You know, I'm in community with other Black women all the time. And so for some of us, there are certain things that we find frightening, and for others, there are other things. And so like for the one, you know, for one Black woman, she may love the whole process of, you know, being pregnant and birthing her children and raising them. And for other Black women, just the thought of carrying a being inside their body is like terrifying. And so, and so these stories are just kind of as a compilation of those. It's like, so these are, and they are pretty classic horror tropes. I mean, it's not like I'm reinventing the horror wheel, but what kind of might make it seem as if I am is the fact that we don't always get to see these women. We just don't. We don't get to see them in horror movies all the time. We don't get to see them in horror stories and horror books. And so it really was important to me to center these experiences. So I do make a conscious effort to write about Black people. That's what I do. And I think that it's really important that we hear those voices and we engage with those experiences, because ultimately they are human experiences, regardless to people who say, oh, I can't connect with the characters or I don't understand the situation. I'm like, well, that's like, kind
of my whole childhood connecting to old dead white dudes. Surely.
Exactly. I'm like, so you mean to tell me that I can connect with, like, let's say Stephen King's work, but you can't connect with this because the people are Black or they're girls. Like, I mean, really.
Like, you tell it on yourself.
Exactly. That's
a better imagination.
Yeah. That sounds like a you problem. So
your
lack of a worldview is kind of not my problem.
Right. I know I 100% agree with you. Like, I mean, obviously, like, you know, I started Nightlight to do exactly, you know, what you're seeking to do in your work, because I think it is important that we consume art from multiple perspectives, you know, not just the experience that we come from. I think that that's how we grow as humans, is understanding other human experiences outside of our own. But the name of your collection is Hell Hath No Sorrow, Like a Woman Haunted. And it is available pretty much everywhere, right?
Yes.
Okay. It is. So, you know, request a copy from your library. If you are unable to purchase your own copy, that's a great way to support authors.
Yes,
you know, buying copies from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, your independent bookstore, if you have one locally that you can order from. If not, you can order from a Black-owned bookstore online at bookshop.org. But yeah, Hell Hath No Sorrow, Like a Woman Haunted, which is just a great title, first of all. But yeah, I mean, I'm very, very excited to read this. Like, I'm just like, it's next up in my queue of things to read when I get to read something that I want to read.
Oh,
because I know that I'm going to love it and I'm going to want to savor it. You know, it's one of those things where, like, I don't want to have to rush through it.
Yes.
And I want, you know, because I know that it's going to be good, because I love your writing so, so much. And I'm so thankful to have had two of your stories on the podcast. You know this, the listeners don't know this, but, you know, I was pestering Rhonda for at least a year to get her to send me, like, literally anything. And then finally I got conflict resolution. And I was like, this story is great. When am I going to get an original R.J. Joseph story?
Right.
And then you hit me with Bettina and I was like, yes. So, like, my life is complete. But I mean, honestly, like, this could be the Rhonda show and I wouldn't be mad about it, if I'm honest. So please make sure you check out Rhonda's short story collection, Hell Hath No Sorrow, Like a Woman Haunted. The author is R.J. Joseph. So don't look up Rhonda, look up R.J. Joseph. And again, remember, you know, requesting from your library is a huge help if you are unable to support an author financially. Make sure you leave reviews everywhere, Goodreads, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, wherever you can review books, leave a review for that book. And make sure that you listen to both Bettina and Conflict Resolution on Nightlight Podcast. And I just want to thank you so much, Rhonda, for being an amazing human, a great friend, and for joining us today so that I could pick your brain on some of the things that I've been dying to talk to you about. But I just felt like it wouldn't be appropriate to pepper you with a bunch of questions. And this interview is the perfect opportunity to interrogate you. So thank you for agreeing to come on.
Yes. Well, thank you for having me. I always love chatting with you. It's always a good time.
Yeah, yeah. You're an amazing person. Thank you so much for joining us. And I will put links to Rhonda's collection in the show notes so that folks can go buy it directly. Thank you so much, Rhonda. I hope we have a great day.
Thank you. You too.
The Fable and Folly Network, where fiction producers flourish.